When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Nuance Dragon Ambient Experience, or DAX for short. Look, this is the DAX co-pilot.
Isn't he cute? He's so cute. I love his little hat.
I do. He's great. And this is AI-powered ambient technology that helps physicians be more efficient and reduce clinical documentation burden that's driving so much burnout. To learn more about how DAX co-pilot can help restore the joy of practicing medicine, stick around after the episode. Or visit nuance.com/discoverDAX. Discover DAX. That's nuance.com/discoverDAX.
Knock, knock, hi.
Knock, knock, hi.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Knock Knock I with Dr. Glockenfleck, and that's me. I'm excited to have you join me today on this fine, sunny Saturday afternoon. It's the weekend, and I figured, you know, it's a beautiful day, so why not be in my close the shades and be in my office and record an episode about eyeballs. Makes sense. Actually, it does make sense that I'm doing this on a day when it's sunny, because we got to talk about the sun. I got my start on social media on Twitter. This is back when it was Twitter. So it was 2016. And I loved it. I loved the community. I loved the medical community there. I started from like nothing, literally zero followers telling ophthalmology jokes. And so I've had this soft spot for Twitter and now X. It's been very hard for me to really like significantly give it up, which I have kind of wanted to do lately. It's just not as fun. A lot of people left that I enjoyed, seeing their thoughts and their jokes. And, it's also hard to generate like meaningful discussion and see the replies from people that I like, because obviously you have to pay for Twitter to really like see all those responses. And the way the algorithm has changed since Elon took over, it's just not as fun. And so I have found myself spending less and less time on it, and part of that's just because now, as opposed to when I started, I have a presence on like every platform out there, because if I don't, people will impersonate me and post my content for me and try to make money off of me. So I kind of have to, it was like forced me to be on all these platforms. But I had an experience that just kind of reinforced how kind of over X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it. I can't call it X. It's still weird. It kind of reinforced that sensation, that feeling that I have. And I saw a tweet by somebody, I don't know who it was. I think it was a physician, mentioned something about, you know, when you see influencers talking about how bad certain things are for you, and he listed the things. And among them was sunscreen and Diet Coke. which obviously it's stirred people up, because basically he was saying, you know, Diet Coke, all these things are really like not bad for you. Like these are at times, some of them are good things, in fact. So it caused a whole stir. Like most people were latching onto the Diet Coke thing. But I was really honestly surprised to see how many people are anti-sunscreen out there. It just kind of made me laugh, and I tweeted something about that. I was like, I'm surprised Like, there are so many people that are just like sunscreen universally just bad, like never use sunscreen. And I made some joke about maybe like, should we get Australia to come talk to these people? Because you know, having spent some time in Australia last year, I have a newfound appreciation for the Australians' ongoing battle with the sun, because it's bright there. You get burned easily down there. Seeing all this like vitriol against big sunscreen, just it was ridiculous. It made me laugh. I tweeted something about it. And then of course I got a lot of comments about people like they're giving me studies about how, you know, the sunscreen has these chemicals in it. And then I got other replies some people were saying that dermatologists only exist because sunscreen exists, which of course is silly, right? It's barely even worth me mentioning. It's like, it just made me think, why am I wasting my time? Like even reading these replies, like I could be doing something so much better with my life. Like talking to all of you about something productive, about something eyeball related. And so that's what I'm going to do now. I was just like, forget this. Like this is ridiculous. I mean, can you imagine like having the insane amount of confidence that it takes to think that you are, you know better than like the entire scientific community, but also that you are more powerful than the sun? It's the sun. Like you can't go toe to toe with the sun. Come on, people. And so I don't know. It's all if I have any like anti sunscreen people listening, like save it. Come on. Like sunscreen is a good thing. It's like, wait, how much data do we need to know like sun causes all these things? So my topic today is related to the sun. All right, we're talking about melanoma. We're talking about melanoma and how it affects the eye, specifically the inside of the eye. But first, let's this comes up every so often. Like if it's not sunscreen, it's something else. Like I feel like anything you put on or in your body, there's going to be something. Fluoride was another one. That was another one. Here in Oregon, we don't have fluoride in the water, and so kids get a bunch of freaking cavities. We have to supplement. We have to do mouthwash every day to make sure we get some kind of fluoride on our teeth. Special treatments, which of course cost a lot at the dentist. And there are a lot of people that be like, if fluoride, it's a big scam. God, come on. It's like, I don't know. Anyway, I'm just a little irritated. I'm a little stressed, a little bit irritated, but that's okay. All right, we're going to turn it into something good. We're going to talk about ocular melanoma. Not a great thing, but something productive. How about that? All right, so first of all, how can sunlight, before we get into the actual like disease we're going to be talking about, how does the sun, the magnificent, scary sun that beats down on us with ultraviolet radiation and can take us out at any moment, send off one of the giant solar flares, and all of a sudden the earth is gone. The all-powerful sun, what can it do to our eyes? That's a good question. So I came up with a quick list of things that the sun can do to your eyes. So obviously, it can progress cataract. We know that. It has a loose association with developing macular degeneration. It's not in like the top five risk factors, but it's there. It can obviously cause skin cancer, including your eyelids, the skin around your eye. It can cause, basal cells, squamous cell carcinoma, melanoma, obviously. And so that's why we're always harping on people like, wear in the summer, wear your sunglasses, put sunscreen on your face, don't put sunscreen in your eye. That's why we have sunglasses, folks, all right? You don't need sunscreen on your eye. We got sunglasses with ultraviolet protection. All right, so wear those sunglasses in the summer if it's bright out. What else can I do? So also you have eyeball cancer as well. So you can get a squamous carcinoma on the surface of your eye, on the conjunctiva. You can get a melanoma of the iris. You can get melanoma of the ciliary body. You can get melanoma of the choroid. The point is, the sun can cause a lot of problems, and not just cancerous lesions. You can get non-cancerous lesions. You can get pinguecula, which is a little kind of fatty-looking little growth on the white part of the eye. And if it grows, turns into this form of scar tissue, basically, that starts growing onto the surface of the eye. It's called the pterygium. Those things can be removed if they start causing problems. And so it just, you know, it just causes problems. You know, so protect yourself from the sun. That's our don't do that eyeball tip of the week, which I don't have a sponsor for yet. Still waiting. Somebody's got to kind of snatch this up. My don't do that eyeball tip of the week is don't forget your sunglasses. Wear sunglasses. Get in the habit of putting protection over your eyes. And it's not just your eyes. It's your eyelids. Skin cancer on the eyelids. People don't think about this because when you're putting sunscreen, those of us who are really diligent about using sunscreen, great on you. In fact, my wife is much better than I am. I forget, but you shouldn't. You should do it. I think she uses like makeup that has sunscreen. I don't know. But anyway, we don't put it right on the margin of the eyelid, right where the eyelid touches the eyeball, where you can get skin cancers. All right. So that's why sunshade, sunglasses are so important. So don't do that eyeball tip of the week. Don't go out in the summer. Starting to get sunny again. We're getting there. We're almost through winter. We're getting close. Start wearing those sunglasses, folks. All right. Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll get into ocular melanoma. Hey everybody, exciting announcement. Do you want to tell them or should I?
Oh, you can.
I'm so excited. Due to popular demand, we're adding more live shows in California. Sunday, March 10th, we'll be at the San Jose Improv. And on Sunday, March 24th, we're returning to the Irvine Improv to share our amazing story called Wife and Death.
Yeah, we'll talk about that time you died.
And came back to life.
It'll be a tragicomic, multimedia, memoir, stage show extravaganza.
You gotta check it out. To buy tickets, click the link in the description below, or you can go to glockenflecken.com/live. We'll see you there. All right, here we go. So we are talking a topic that I'm not an expert in. Obviously, I'm like an eye expert, but this is a little bit of a specialized thing. It's choroidal malignant melanoma. Choroidal malignant melanoma. This may come as a shock to people. And sometimes it's a little scary to hear this, that you have tissue in the back of your eye called the choroid. All right, it's a layer, it's underneath your retina that has pigment, that has melanocytes in it, that can develop a melanoma or a nevus or a freckle, or it basically is just a pigmented spot that can be there. You can have that in the back of your eye. So if you have melanocytes somewhere, obviously you can get a melanoma because it's a malignant growth that comes from melanocytes. So you can, this is why, in part, why we do recommend that everybody at some point you have a dilated eye exam or some kind of eye screening where you can look for precursors of potentially a melanoma, which would be what we call a nevus, just a collection of melanocytes. So it's like a little dark, just like you can get a little mole or freckle on your skin. Well, you can get those in the back of your eye. All right. And so obviously we can't look at those ourselves. We can monitor our own freckles, which reminds me, I need to get in to see the dermatologist. It's been a while. I've had things. You know, there's always excuses, guys. Like, I'm no different. The doctors are terrible patients. I need to get in to get my ICD checked too. I'm falling behind. Can you keep me accountable, please? Can someone every so often email me and remind me to go to the doctor? I feel like I need that. Anyway. I need to go to the dermatologist to get all my little spots checked. I'm starting to get some seborrheic keratoses. I got one up here. I did the age spots. The age spots are coming. All right. As I'm nearing 40. I don't want to get off track here, though. But so anyway, that's one thing that we always look for whenever we do like a routine eye exam for someone. Here's we're just looking around at the entire retina and just seeing if there's anything we need to be concerned about. And one of those things would be a pigmented spot like a nevus or potentially a melanoma. Now, malignant melanoma is very rare. This is not common. All right. It's like maybe seven cases per million or one per 7 million. Anyway, the point is, I don't remember the exact like epidemiology, but it's like, it's extraordinarily rare. And of course, it's more common in certain areas of the country. I did my residency training in Iowa, and we had a lot of Iowa farmers, a lot of people who spent their entire life outside. A lot of them didn't use proper eye protection, and so we got a lot of melanoma, more in Iowa, Nebraska, and basically the Midwest farming country than you would see in other areas of the country. Up here in Portland, Oregon, where it's overcast a lot, people spend a lot of the winter inside because it's raining. There's just not as much. There's just not as much choroidal melanoma, but it can happen. Obviously, it can happen. It's not the only. There's other risk factors besides just sun exposure. So other risk factors for developing a malignant melanoma, and again, we're talking about choroidal today. Because that's the most common. Melanoma of the iris is a possibility. Melanoma of the conjunctiva is a possibility. You have pigmented tissue there. It's just not as common. All right. And I think it's more interesting to talk about the choroidal melanoma. So this is the melanoma again that affects the retina. We see it on a dilated eye exam. So risk factors. If you already have a nevus or multiple nevi in the back of the eye. Obviously, that's a risk factor because it can transform into a malignant melanoma. Race is a big consideration. So white people have a much higher risk of melanoma. We see the vast majority of choroidal melanomas in white patients. Only about 1 to 2% in black population and the Asian population. So it's much less common in more darkly pigmented patients. We saw a lot of it in Iowa. Cigarette smoking has a risk of melanoma associated with it. Other things, less common things like neurofibromatosis, dysplastic nevus syndrome, bilateral diffuse uveal melanocytic proliferation, or Badump syndrome. That's one of my favorites. Badump, B-D-U-M-P, Badump syndrome. I don't think I've ever actually seen that. Anyway, these things also have carry a risk of melanoma. Again, it's rare, extremely uncommon before the age of 40. So it's almost universally seen over the age of 40. So older patients, and I'm always careful. I don't want to be people to think I'm calling them old because I'm nearing 40. I'm almost over 40 now. And so all these things I have to start thinking about too. So a lot of the times the symptoms, it can be asymptomatic. You know, you don't know until you just find it on exam. But when people do have symptoms, that does increase the risk that it's going to be something significant, like a melanoma versus a non malignant lesion. So blurred vision. So if you have, obviously, the closer this lesion is to the center of your vision, the fovea, the macula, the optic nerve, those really important structures at the very back of the eye, the closer the melanoma is to those structures, the more likely you are to get to have symptoms that bring you into the doctor. Some of the saddest cases I think I saw in residency were the patients that had it out in the periphery. So the far outside part of the retina that's not responsible for your high acuity central vision. If you have a melanoma starting to grow out there, you may not have symptoms for quite a while before it gets big enough that it starts to grow into the more of that center part of your vision. That's always the worst case scenario. And it's probably, it's less likely that's going to happen because a lot of the the ultraviolet light coming in from the sun is obviously going to like get right there on the back of the eye in the macula, that important part of your vision. So blurred vision, people can have like floaters. I've seen that described in people with a diagnosis of malignant melanoma. Visual field loss. So you have like this area of your vision that's grayed or blacked out, flashes and floaters, because as this lesion grows and gets taller and bigger, it can cause retinal detachments. And so people can have a curtain coming over their vision. You can have flashes and floaters. We've talked about that with regard to retinal detachments. And then what we see when we look back there is we'll see this dome-shaped structure. It's sometimes it can be subtle. So when I see a patient, say it's just like your average dilated exam, and I see a pigmented spot back there, I can usually tell if there's any elevation to it just with the naked eye using a lens. Not a naked eye, I'm using a lens. That would be incredible if I could just use my naked eye, just real get real close to you and just peer into your eye. That would save me a lot of time, but no, I can't do that. I don't have that kind of vision. So using a lens, I'll look back there, but with our lens technology, our ophthalmoscopes, our various devices that we use, I can usually tell if a pigmented spot in the retina is flat, which is what we would see with a nevus, or if it's elevated, which is more likely to be a melanoma. Now, not all elevated lesions are melanoma. Once it gets above a certain height, that's when you start getting concerned. It's like 1 millimeter high. And so if there's any elevation at all to it, what I do as a comprehensive ophthalmologist is I will send that patient over to a retina specialist. We have wonderful retina specialists, and what they will do is take a look back there, and they'll use an ultrasound to measure this lesion. Now, I am on the record. I have a strained relationship with ultrasound. I have railed against ultrasound at times for different reasons, but we do use ultrasound in ophthalmology, and we use it in specialized situations like this when we need to measure an elevated some kind of lesion in the back of the eye, because it's not just melanomas. There's osteomas, there's hemangiomas, there's other things that can cause like this elevated lesion back there. But what we'll do is use ultrasound, and we have like ocular ultrasonographers. We had 2 of them in Iowa during residency. Usually it's only academic centers that have this type of service. Phenomenal. Unbelievable. Like, I learned so much that I've since forgotten about how to do like a proper ophthalmic ultrasound. There's a lot to it. It's not just putting it on the eye, which is kind of what I do for certain things. But when you really need to measure like the height, width, depth, length of these important lesions, because this helps you determine, is this something that needs to be treated? You want someone with that kind of experience. Unfortunately, they're harder and harder to find these days. So shout out to all the ocular ultrasound folks out there. You are very much valued in ophthalmology. Sorry, my kids are, I'm trying to power through here. My kids are screaming outside, and this is not a soundproof room. So hopefully that doesn't distract you as much as it's distracting me. I'll do my best here. All right. So we've done an ultrasound. Let's say we have a patient who has this lesion. It's an elevated lesion. We get an ultrasound. There are certain ultrasound characteristics that make us concerned. There's low internal reflectivity in a malignant melanoma lesion, typically, which gives us more concern about melanoma, obviously. So it's also the height, the size of it, some of those characteristics. And then we, you know, use that with our clinical examination to determine, is this something that is likely to be melanoma or not? Now, for a spot on your skin, it's much more straightforward. You do a punch biopsy, you shave it, you do an excisional biopsy, whatever. You can take it out and or take a piece of it, or however they do it in dermatology, and determine it. Now, it's much harder and more challenging to get a piece of a melanoma. In fact, you don't do that. You don't do it because if you go and put a needle into the eye, into the back of the eye, and try to pull out cells to evaluate, you could spread that melanoma. It's very easy to do. You could cause more trouble if you try to do that. So we don't biopsy potential ocular melanoma lesions. We will use all these other clues to say, okay, what is the likelihood that this is a malignant lesion that we need to treat? The biggest thing is size. So there's this big study. I'm not going to go through over the details, but basically, if it's a large enough lesion based on this study, it divided melanomas into small, medium, and large. Okay, so small melanomas, you could just observe those. All right, we're talking very small. Ones that we're not even totally sure if it's a melanoma. You could watch it. You watch it carefully, measure it every 6 months or so, or every 3 months, and see if there's any growth. All right, so you can watch those because they're small. The risk of metastasis is very, very low if it's a small lesion. When they get to a medium-sized lesion, based on this study, then what the study showed was that there's no difference in survival between doing an enucleation or brachytherapy. All right. So at this point, with a medium-sized melanoma, you know, it qualifies as that size. We are comfortable calling it a melanoma. We know this is a malignant lesion. All right, or at least has a very, very high enough likelihood that we want to treat it. So you could do one of two things. You could either do brachytherapy, or you can do it just a primary enucleation, which means take out the eye. So most people do choose the brachytherapy, obviously, because if there's no difference in survival, then you know most people want to save their eye and save as much vision as they can. And this is a really cool, one of probably the coolest things that ophthalmologists do. And there's not a lot of people out there that do this brachytherapy. You take these detailed measurements using ultrasound of the lesion, so you know exactly how long it is down to the tenth of a millimeter, and you order a radioactive plaque. It's radioactive iodine. You order this plaque that's iodine 125. And what you do is you take the patient to the operating room and you put it right over the melanoma. You suture it to the eye. You suture it to the eye and you leave it there for X amount of time. I've seen it from like 72 hours to 4 days, 5 days, maybe. It depends on the size and everything. And this is outside my area of expertise, but the patient will be in the hospital. So this is done in this is tertiary medical center type of stuff here. We had somebody at Iowa, shout out Culver Bolt, amazing, amazing work that he did. He had a whole clinic full of melanomas. And so the patient will be admitted to the hospital while they have this thing on the eye. All right. Because it's very, you don't want this thing moving. You don't want something to happen. So you really got to watch these patients. You keep them in the hospital. You're checking on them. We rounded on these patients daily, check and make sure that the plaque was still in the right place. And then, and that surgery, it's so precise. It's so precise and difficult. Shout out to the people that do that, to put this plaque on, because if you get it in the wrong spot, then you're basically killing off normal retina. Like you have to localize it right over that melanoma lesion. All right. You don't want it over the optic nerve. You don't want it over the fovea, because then you're going to kill off all the vision. Right. So it's got to be just perfectly placed. And then after X amount of hours, based on this nomogram or something, we take the plaque off. So the plaque, the radiation, it kills the melanoma. Now there's risk, there's side effects of this, obviously. Like you're going to have what's called, you might have radiation retinopathy, where you get all these abnormal blood vessels that start growing into the retina over the course of months to years. That can cause vision loss down the road. But the great thing is with these medium-sized melanomas, you know, you can kill off the melanoma and potentially still preserve some decent vision for a patient. As opposed to a nucleation where you're just taking out the eye. That's a topic for another day. As, of course, as part of the evaluation for a patient that has a melanoma, you check for metastasis. So the most common place for a metastasis in the liver. So you're getting all these liver screenings, the lab tests, imaging, all this stuff to make sure there's no sign of any metastasis to the liver. Because if there's metastasis, that changes your that changes everything. If you have a signs of a metastasis, you're going to want to just, I'm not sure what you do in that case. It's been a while, folks. I'm doing the best I can. This is a multidisciplinary effort. And then for really big tumors, that's where it's too large to suture a plaque onto the eye. You can't do the radiation. Those patients will just have an enucleation, because thank goodness we have two eyes, folks. I love having two of the, I've said this before, I'll say it again. I love having two of the organ that I am a specialist in. It's fantastic. All right. We get, it's like having two lives in a video game. It's great. Enucleation is always an option, where we remove the eye and replace it with a prosthetic, and they do amazing things with prosthetics. That's the rundown. That's choroidal melanoma. Now, I hope I didn't scare you all. Don't be scared. This is a rare thing. Okay. It's rare. Here it is. I found it. 6 to 7 cases per million people. So that's rare. That is very rare. It's a little bit more frequent in men than women. We talked about the race implications. More common among white people. What else did I miss? There's a genetic component to it, but there's no specific genetic defects. I'm looking at irounds.org. I've shouted out irounds before, but this is from Iowa, so they are like the epicenter of melanoma treatment in the US, in my honest opinion. That's pretty much it. All right, so there you go. That's probably more than you ever knew about ocular melanoma. How about the do that eyeball tip of the week? Go get your eye exam. Good. Ophthalmologist, optometrist, whatever eye doctor you have locally, any kind of eye doctor can look at the back of the eye and look for any weird stuff. All right. You can ask, you see a nevus in there? You see a weird, any kind of pigmented tissue back there? Or they can tell you. They'll tell you. And I've had optometrists refer patients with kind of funny looking lesions in the back of the eye sent to me to see, could this possibly be a melanoma? Usually it's not. The only way to know is to go get it checked out. And if you don't have any lesions, then thank goodness. I'm glad for that. And you can take comfort in that. But even if you do, even if you have a nevus, you know, my mom, who's going to listen to this, she's got a nevus. And every time she comes up to see us, I take her into the clinic and I dilate her eye. I take a look at that thing, make sure it hasn't changed, because we got a little skin cancer in the family. So get checked out, but don't worry. All right, we'll take good care of you in ophthalmology land. All right, thank you all for joining me on this episode of Knock Knock Eye. Again, give me your recommendations. Give me your feedback. Tell me if this was helpful. You know, I have been made aware of the fact that there are many medical professionals who are using Knock Knock Eye for all of their eyeball education. So I do feel compelled to tell you, you don't get CME for this. You should. How do I do that? Can someone just tell me how I can like figure that out? All right. I don't want to charge anybody for it, but it'd be nice to be able to like have you just, you know, tell your CME, your medical board, hey, I listened to 10 episodes of Knock Knock Eye. Can I have all my CME? I'll give you as much as you want. You want 20 hours of CME? Let's do it. I think I have probably maybe close to 20 hours of Knock Knock Eye episodes. Just go on a binge. Send it to all your friends, all right? As long as you keep listening, folks, I'm going to keep making these episodes. So thank you again. Thanks again for joining me. Thank you to my producers, Shanti Brick, Aaron Corney, Rob Goldman. Editor and engineer is Jason Portizo. Our music is by Omer Benzvi. This is a Human Content production. See you next time.